The new developments in the Karen Reed murder trial.
This has been a wild turn of events.
I've seen a lot of things. I've never seen anything like this. This case never ceases to amaze me.
It's a spectacle, that's for sure.
It was a hung jury, so no verdict, no real ending to this case.
Karen Reed was back in court where a date was set for her to be tried once again.
There are a lot of issues in this case.
Proctor was improperly searching Karen Reed's cell phone for nude photos.
Michael Proctor, the lead investigator, relieved of his duties.
It's always the theories that each side will put forth for a jury to decide which one is more believable.
Karen Reed was drunk and angry and hit and killed John O'Keefe when she gunned it in the snowstorm.
Karen, did you ever say I hit him?
I did not.
There are more people here at the beginning of this than at the beginning of Johnny Depp's trial.
We're not concerned about any of the witnesses. None of the Commonwealth's witnesses are concerning us.
And once again, there was drama outside court.
There is a whole new set of legal troubles for Karen Reed. She is now facing a wrongful death lawsuit.
The lawsuit alleges that Karen Reed was drunk and reckless when she hit John O'Keefe.
It's not just Reed being sued here. The family also suing the two Canton bars from that night.
The two bars are liable for over-serving her.
The FBI is investigating an investigation of a murder. That never, ever happens.
At this point, multiple jurors have been reaching out to both sides, saying that they are certain Karen Reed is not a killer.
I did not kill John O'Keefe. I've never harmed a hair on John O'Keefe's head.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks.
There are 17 jurors, and they are coming and going with a police escort.
The investigation wasn't thorough.
This can't be good for the prosecution moving forward.
I just hope justice is served for either one, whatever it is, you know?
The fate of her life is not in her hands anymore. It's not in the hands of her attorneys. It's not in the hands of the prosecutor. It's in the hands of the jury now.
With Karen Reed's second trial date quickly approaching, her attorneys and the prosecution have been very busy filing all of the last-minute motions on the different ways that they're hoping to limit the opposing side's arguments during the next trial. Now, the judge set a deadline for each side to file all of their motions in limine, and she set a deadline for when each side has to file their response. Now, a motion in limine is what an attorney files when they want to exclude specific evidence or arguments. Anything from being presented to the jury during trial. It could be something that they feel should be inadmissible or something that could make the jury feel a prejudice toward the defendant. And the judge acts as the gatekeeper to decide what the jury can hear and what will be left out. Now, we were back in court in Norfolk twice this week to go over these motions and some other issues. And as always in this trial, there was some drama. Both hearings on both days started with a bang. First, let's get into what happened on Tuesday. Judge Ganoni started out by addressing the ARCA issues with the defense. Now, I'm not going to rehash the entire situation. We've been over it in depth. But the judge is really mad at the defense team because she says that she believes that there were misrepresentations from the defense to the court about the relationship with ARCA witnesses. And Judge Ganoni said that she believes that those misrepresentations were deliberate. She said that the defense intentionally misrepresented to her that they had not paid ARCA in order to mislead her and the prosecution. Now, I can't say that I agree with this. I don't think that this was deliberate, especially since the defense found those emails and information and turned it over shortly after that. She calls a sidebar and talks to Karen about continuing on with her attorneys, and Karen, of course, lets the judge know that she has a strong desire to continue with her current lawyers. Canoni says that she is not going to revoke Jackson's pro hoc vice, meaning she's not going to kick him off the case for this, but she reiterates again how candor with the court is essential.
Candor with the court is essential. It's the bedrock obligation of all lawyers who appear in this court and all courts in Massachusetts. A lawyer is only as good as his or her word, and I need to be able to take counsel at their word. So, I'm not going to tolerate false statements, any stretching of the truth, no misleading distortions. There's no place for that in the courtroom.
She's not wrong about candor to the court being essential, or about any of the things that she just said in this clip. But the situation was really frustrating to watch for me because the judge has not come at the prosecution with the same energy. I don't agree with the judge saying that there have been multiple flagrant, deliberate misrepresentations to the court. That's not what I've seen. But I have seen that from Brennan recently, which makes this really hard to watch. The prosecution team is supposed to be held to an even higher standard than the defense, and Hank Brennan has made repeated misrepresentations to the court, big ones, and has caused a lot of headache with this wrong information, wrong accusations, and then he's really quiet on his corrections of the record. Everything that she just said here 100% should have been said to Brennan as well. Actually, probably more, because the rules are stricter and he's done it so often. It's definitely frustrating to see the energy that the judge gives the defense on this topic when she doesn't hold the prosecution to the same standard. And this is information that the defense did turn over. It's not like they found out about this some other way and the defense got busted, like what Brennan originally said. The defense is the one who turned everything over in discovery. I can't help but wonder how different this trial would be if there were a judge who were more balanced when it came to the way that things were being handled. I gave Judge Cannone the benefit of the doubt for so long, but the closer we get to this trial, the harder she's making it to do that. So the final decision here is that she's not imposing sanctions or kicking Jackson off the team, and she's going to let Arca testify, which is the right thing to do. Excluding the jury from hearing exculpatory evidence would be a huge mistake. But she does tell Hank Brennan that she will allow a full cross-examination of the witness. That's a weird thing to say, since a full cross-examination is allowed for every witness, and it came across as her basically telling Brennan to go ahead and hit them as hard as you can with this information during cross. And then she says something about giving limiting instructions to the jury, which, again, doesn't seem to make much sense here. They do agree that the cost of paying Arca to come out to court for the voir dire won't be brought up, which that actually does make sense. The Commonwealth wanted a voir dire of Arca, so to turn around and then throw the cost of that out to the jury, that can be misleading, making it seem like the defense paid this huge amount so that they would just come and say whatever they wanted Arca to say. But the expenses to pay them to come testify during trial will probably be brought up during cross, and I'd bet money that Brennan will make a big deal about it, especially with the judge's little hint there. Now, Arca was the topic of discussion again on Thursday. The defense wants to be able to tell the jury who hired Arca. They don't want to get into details of the federal investigation or the federal grand jury. They just want to be able to say that it was the U.S. Attorney's Office that hired them. Now, Brennan, of course, opposes this. He says that the defense is trying to show that Arca was independent at the time that they did their investigation and their report. But he says that that's unfair. Now, Brennan and Lally both have had a big issue with Arca from day one, which makes sense. The Crash Daddies are probably the two most damaging witnesses for their case. Both Lally and Brennan have insinuated repeatedly that the defense team handed over discovery to the U.S. Attorney's Office for them to give to Arca, and they don't know what was handed over and what wasn't. For more than a year now, we've heard the Commonwealth imply that the defense cherry-picked specific discovery to give to the feds. Like they're going to turn over the things that look good for them, but hide the things that look bad for them, or something like that. And Brennan does the same thing again during this hearing. He also speculates on how there must be more communication that he isn't aware of, and he wants Arca to have to come answer questions for him about their directives from the U.S. Attorney's Office and what they reviewed. Now, some of these things have already been answered. Arca was very specific in their voir dire, their testimony, and their report about the specific things that they reviewed for their testing. And they were clear that it was the USAO who decided what discovery they were supposed to use to do this, not the defense. But when Unetti gets up to address all of this, we hear this for the very first time.
The Commonwealth suggested that it was the defense that was playing hide the ball, when that inference is, again, the furthest thing from the truth. In terms of the information that the federal government got, Mr. Brennan engages in a ton of speculation about what happened or didn't happen based on nothing. There's no affidavit to establish any of that. I will tell the court that I received a subpoena for my entire file from the federal government, and I complied with that subpoena. We had nothing to hide. We provided everything that the Commonwealth provided to us, to the federal government. They chose what to give ARCA or what not to give ARCA, and they did that again to preserve the scientific integrity of their opinion.
So that answers a lot of questions, and it goes directly against a lot of prosecution's accusations. The feds had everything that the Commonwealth had given the defense. Now, I'm not sure why these DAs are all acting like it's so wild that the U.S. Attorney's Office is getting their discovery from the defense instead of them, especially since we've seen the federal letters. We know how the U.S. Attorney's Office felt about the Norfolk DA's office, so why would they ask them for stuff? But maybe that will clear up a few things for the prosecution during the trial. All right, so now we know where they got their information, but Brennan still wants the ARCA experts to come back again and do another voir dire. Again. He wants them to have to answer his questions and give him any reports or anything that he wants to know. Again. Now, the judge agrees and says that it should be done next week. The defense team is kind of confused on why. What exactly are they looking for now? We've been through this already. The judge does later decide that they can just do the voir dire the day before they testify, but it's still going to have to be done. Again. Now, Judge Cannone says that she's unlikely to grant the defense's request about letting the jury know, and she wants Unetti to explain how bringing up the U.S. Attorney's Office won't open the door to more of the federal investigation stuff. Now, Unetti tries to answer, and Judge Cannone interrupts him. So, look, this is a pattern. Now, if you're listening to this podcast as a supplement or a breakdown of the hearing, but you're watching along in real time and seeing what's happening, you already know this. She interrupts Unetti and Jackson a lot. Occasionally, Alessi and Little, rarely Brennan, but Jackson and Unetti are constantly interrupted. Between that and Brennan's accusations and jabs that he's taking at them all the time, I think this defense team is kind of getting a little sick of it. There was a tense moment in court when this happened again on Thursday.
If I allow, and I'd be very surprised if I did, mention that this was a federal grand jury and that the federal, how does that not open the door to all the testimony that Mr. Brennan just brought up that he'd be able to get into?
Okay, so first of all, and this is later in my argument. We're not asking.
So no, could you answer that now, and then I'll let you say everything.
I'm trying to, Your Honor.
Oh, you just said it's late. Hold on. You just said it's later in the argument.
I know, but you interrupted me, and I was just about to say, but I'll address it now.
Okay.
Yikes! The tension is high, y'all. Now, I doubt the judge is going to rule in favor of this request for the defense, and the defense also asked for the judge to allow them to state the grounds for their objections during this trial, like objection, hearsay, or objection, foundation. It lets the record be very clear about why there's an objection. And I can't even believe that this wasn't allowed in the first trial. That's something that I've never seen before. But the judge denied it. No transparency here. They also asked not to have sidebars impounded this time. And the judge didn't like that idea either. She said that last time they all agreed that they would be impounded. And Unetti reminded her, she said, this is a new trial. She told Brennan to find out about the authority to make that decision. Now, the Commonwealth has asked that the buffer zone around the courthouse be extended. The buffer zone was put in place for the last trial to keep protesters at a distance so that the jury didn't see or hear them. But at least one juror said that they could hear yelling at some point during deliberations, and people are honking when they drive by. The defense had no objection to this, but the judge did point out one thing in Brennan's motion that she said isn't a court thing, it's a law enforcement thing. Brennan said in his motion that he wanted the police to be able to use reasonable physical force to arrest a person and ensure compliance. What's with this guy? We'll be right back after this. Okay, y'all, let's talk about a few things that both sides did agree on. One thing that they both agreed on, the Aruba stuff. You'll remember from the first trial that John and Karen went on a trip to Aruba for New Year's Eve. The Sullivan sisters came and testified at the last trial about the trip, saying that there was a verbal argument between Karen and one of the sisters because Karen got angry because she thought that that girl and John had kissed. Now, this was brought in during the last trial because Lally tried to say that it somehow provided a motive for murder. It came across as a desperate attempt from the prosecution. Nobody is going to believe that an argument between Karen and another girl, not even between Karen and John, caused her to murder John a month later. There's no history of violence between them, and the fight wasn't even between the two of them. It was between Karen and this other girl. So she gets on the stand, and her testimony basically sounds like just petty, mean girl stuff. She says that she told her friends that Karen sucks and called her an asshole. She says that Karen told her during the argument to go F herself. And then the next night, Karen paid for everyone's dinner, I guess as an olive branch for the argument between her and the girl. Now, she also said that when they were planning the trip, that Karen wanted her own bathroom. And she said that John let her know that he was unhappy in their relationship because of a shrug and an eye roll in a conversation that they have. Basically, they went through a bad night in Aruba, and the Commonwealth wanted to insinuate that this is somehow cause for murder a month later. So the defense wanted this excluded in the trial. They say it's just a bunch of stuff to try to get the jury not to like Karen, and it has nothing to do with actual evidence. Plus, they say it's an inadmissible hearsay. So Brennan says that he doesn't intend on introducing the Aruba stuff unless somehow the defense opens the Aruba door. So as of now, it's out. Another thing that they agreed on is that expert Richard Green's arrest from almost 10 years ago won't be brought into trial. So the digital expert for the defense was apparently at the beach, at a bar, and intoxicated, as are most people at beach bars. According to the arrest record, Green was overserved and they asked him to leave. When he was walking out, they say that he fell after stumbling. But his story was that he was pushed to the ground by one of the bar employees. Now, I live in a beach town full of little beach bars, so I kind of laughed when I read this because if I had a dime for every time I've seen this happen. But regardless, when someone dug this up, it suddenly started circulating around social media, and somehow a drunk beach bar incident from 2016 turned into not being able to rely on Green's expert opinion on data in 2025. Now, I have to point out the irony that, like, every witness in this case was at the bar the night this happened, drinking, and a lot of them were driving, but the only credibility that's questioned now is apparently this one, when his night of drinking in a bar was almost a decade ago and has nothing to do with the case. Kind of wild, isn't it? But regardless, the defense filed a motion and his arrest won't be brought up at trial. Another motion that was agreed on was no talking to the witnesses after they've taken the stand. Now, the defense filed this motion to keep the prosecutors, law enforcement, and witness advocates from talking to the witnesses because during the first trial, it came out that Lally had talked to Brian Albert while they were on a court recess and told him some things that he was going to ask on redirect. That's not supposed to happen, so this was agreed on by all parties. They also addressed the issue of sequestration for the witnesses. Now, this is basically a rule that keeps witnesses who are going to be testifying from watching or attending the trial, because, of course, it could influence their testimony. Now, they aren't allowed to see what others say, because then they could potentially change their own testimony to fit what has been said, or it could alter their memory, things like that. So once the evidence has been presented, the witnesses are allowed to watch. Basically, that means that they can be present for closing arguments. And we know that during the last trial, some of the witnesses did show up for closing arguments. So here's the problem. We know that there were jurors who specifically said that having Brian Albert sitting directly across from them, staring at them, was intimidating. Now, this is a very small courtroom. Having the third-party culprits presented by the defense sitting directly across from you, staring at you, yeah, I could see how that would be intimidating. But there's something that has always bothered me about this. I remember when I first saw that they were there, it was Brian Albert, Jen McCabe, Carrie Roberts, and Colin Albert. And I was streaming the trial live on my YouTube channel, and I remember saying that I felt like that was intentional because the family of John O'Keefe wanted to send a message to the jury that they didn't believe the defense's theory, and they didn't want the jury to either. That feeling was confirmed when John's brother, Paul O'Keefe, did an interview after the trial and told WCVB Channel 5 that he specifically invited them for that reason.
During closing arguments, he invited some of the people the defense had tried to implicate in his brother's death to sit with his family.
It was just our way of saying, you know, we don't believe in any of this stuff.
But it turns out it might not just be Paul O'Keefe that wanted to send this message to the jury. Karen Reed's attorney, Liza Little, said during the hearing that they have evidence showing that the prosecutors and Massachusetts State Police wanted these third-party culprits seated right there with the O'Keefe family on the day of closing arguments. It was intentional. So the defense has asked that the judge keep them out of the courtroom after they've testified in order to protect any undue influence, intimidation, or just a juror feeling like there's intimidation. Obviously, protecting the jurors from the outside influence is imperative to a fair trial. That's the most important thing here, right? So this motion, to me, is a no-brainer. But Brennan even fights back on this one. So there are two parts to this whole sequestration thing. Brennan filed a motion that the family members of John O'Keefe shouldn't have to be sequestered during the trial. Now, that's not uncommon. It happens in a lot of trials because the family members are going to want to be in there for the trial. They want to support each other and see what's happening, things like that. Now, Brennan also included Karen Reed's parents and brother in his motion, meaning he may call them as witnesses, but he doesn't need them to be kept out of the courtroom. So both sides agreed on that part. None of the family members should be sequestered or kept out of the courtroom. But Brennan does not want the Alberts and McCabes to be kept from sitting with the O'Keefes during closing arguments. Now, when he gets up to respond to the defense's request for this, the judge tells him specifically that she was wanting to hear about the sequestration during closings. But he kind of ignores that and spends most of the time focusing on how much grace he thinks he has shown by not trying to keep Karen's family out of the courtroom in case he wants to call them. Almost like, hey, look how nice I am. How dare you even ask for more? He also uses his theatrics to try to spin it to get his way. Take a listen.
I think it's unfortunate that not only a time-honored tradition, but an entitlement for a witness after the evidence is closed to come into the closing and watch the closing. The defense tries to take an opportunity to provide an unsolicited bashing on their targets. They name Higgins, Albert, they invoke those names, they characterize third-party culprit, and they suggest that some anonymous person was uncomfortable.
Okay, so not once did Brennan show any concern for how the jurors may feel, but he is very concerned with how the Alberts and McCabes may feel and what they are entitled to. Brennan accuses the defense of bashing their targets when they specifically said that this is to prevent undue influence over the jury. Brennan also minimizes the jurors' feelings by saying that the defense is suggesting that some anonymous person was uncomfortable. The defense didn't suggest this. It's literally in the Vanity Fair interview. But the juror didn't want to be named. The juror said that they felt it was utterly inappropriate that the Albert and McCabe families were able to stare down the jury from their position in the courtroom, and said that they felt intimidated. Another juror, who did allow his name to be shared, said the same thing about how it was tough to have them staring directly at them during closings. Brennan doesn't care. He opposes this, and instead of giving any arguments about why it shouldn't matter, other than entitlement, he then begins talking about how he offered grace by not asking Karen's family to be kept out of the courtroom.
Grace can be offered in these circumstances sometimes, and that's what I've tried to do in my motion.
Oh, ADA Brennan, full of grace. He says it isn't fair or balanced to keep these witnesses from coming and sitting with the O'Keefes to send this message to the jury, and he wants the judge to deny it. The defense also requested that there be a panel voir dire for jury selection, meaning that they want to be able to ask some of the questions to multiple jurors at the same time when they're going through the jury selection process. It saves time to do it like this instead of having to talk to each potential juror individually, but with this case being so high profile and there being so much publicity, the judge says no to this one. The concern is that if one juror says something in front of the whole group, it can taint the group and then they all have to be dismissed as potential jurors. So this one is a no-go, and I actually agree with that decision. Now, the defense also requested that they be allowed to enter a visual aid to help the jury understand the glass testimony. Here's the deal with this one. This is all about the glass that was recovered through the investigation from the yard, from Karen's bumper, and then the one piece that Proctor said that he found in the road. The testimony gets really confusing because everything is labeled in numbers and letters, and they're comparing everything against each other. It's just a lot. Even the analyst who testified, Christina Hanley, had to keep referring to her notes, and she had trouble keeping up with it. She kept having to ask Lally and Jackson to repeat their questions while she flipped through her report. So here's kind of the summary. We know that they found parts of a drinking glass because they were able to find the base of the glass, plus six pieces that matched that in the yard. They were also able to find three other pieces of glass in the yard that did not match the cocktail glass. Then there were five pieces of glass from Karen's bumper, but none of that was matched to the cocktail glass. Then there was one piece of glass that Proctor said that he found in the road, but it also was not from the cocktail glass. It was consistent, however, with one of the pieces of glass from Karen's bumper. They couldn't determine if it was definitely a match, but it was consistent. So basically, there's a broken cocktail glass in the yard and some other type of glass on Karen's bumper. And the problem is that the pieces that are found in the yard are labeled like 7-12 with subcategories A, B, C, D, E, F, I, K, and L. And then the base of the glass is 3-2 and the piece on the road is 7-14, et cetera, et cetera. So people tend to zone out. I'm sure you probably zoned out just as I was reading that. So a visual helps with this. It keeps them from getting confused, right? Jackson made this very simplified visual chart in the last trial, and Hanley saw it and confirmed that it represented what her testimony was, and it wasn't admitted into evidence. So this time, Jackson wants to admit that into evidence. Easy enough, right? But Brennan opposes this as well. Brennan's argument is that Hanley did a report, and this is a summary of that report, and he doesn't think that it's fair to put it in evidence. He also brings up the new documentary that aired the night before, where he says that Karen Reed said that John took her vodka soda glass out of the car when he got out, and she said that she pulled glass off of John's face when she arrived. Now, Brennan says that these are two things that have never been said before, and he saw them in this documentary, and now the glass is becoming a thing that he wants to look at closer. So there you have it. Now, I haven't watched it yet, but I did find the clip of this part because I've learned that you cannot take Brennan at his word when he says anything. So it was interesting because in the clip, Karen says that there was a tiny piece of glass that was perched or wedged how a splinter would be. And she said that she just pulled it off of John's nose. And as soon as she did, blood gushed down his face. Now, the nose is very vascular, which means it bleeds a lot when something happens to it, right? But also for blood to gush, that usually means that the heart is pumping because that's what pushes the blood through our bodies. And we also know that Karen had blood on her face after she tried to do CPR to save John. And we heard that in testimony from Jason Becker with Canton Fire Department. So the blood on his face thing kind of makes sense there. But this little detail definitely brings up some more questions for me. Like, where did this little piece of glass come from? Dr. Scortibello testified to a small cut on the left side of John's nose, and that's also in the statement of case. Also, back at the very beginning of the investigation, Buchanick thought that it was a domestic situation and John had been hit in the face with a glass. So this is not totally out of left field or anything, but now it just brings up more questions about what happened to John to make him get glass in his face. The prosecution says that he was hit in the arm by the car and that plastic tail lens did the damage that we've seen. So glass in the face doesn't really fit with that. So how did the glass get there? Now, if it was a piece of plastic tail lens in his nose, that would be a totally different story, but it's glass. Now, I've known this documentary was coming for a while. I was actually interviewed for this documentary along with some other journalists and content creators who have been covering it in depth. And we were notified that a lot of our interviews were cut out of the documentary, which doesn't surprise me since Karen and the defense team were willing to allow them to follow her and film a lot of hours with her. Now, of course, that's more of what they're going to show, but with the filming of interviews comes the risk of everything you say being scrutinized and used against you. Brennan has made it clear that he's using every clip he can find of Karen saying anything during trial. And I almost always think it's a bad idea for defendants to speak publicly or take the stand. It's a risk that she took, and now Brennan is pouncing on it. So, I don't know, we'll see how that goes. A couple of other quick topics before we get into some of the big stuff. The viewing that the jury did last year where they went to 34 Fairview and they saw Karen's car, the defense is asking for the jury to do that again for this trial. And this time they want Karen to go as well. Now, Judge Cannone doesn't have an issue with that if they can figure out the logistics of getting Karen there separately from the jurors. But Brennan does have an issue with the car being there. He says it doesn't represent weather and lighting conditions on how they were that night. Now, I don't know why that matters. That's kind of not the point of this, but he objects. I doubt the judge will deny this, though, and rule in favor of Brennan on this one, because it's a very weak objection. And also, I'm sure that she doesn't want to have to schedule a separate location for the jurors to have to go to see the car. Another motion that they heard was the extrapolation situation. This is the testing that was done where they came up with that really big range of Karen's estimated blood alcohol levels. When Karen was in the hospital, her blood was drawn, but it was drawn for medical purposes, not forensic purposes. The report even says this is not intended for use in court-related proceedings. So here we are in a court-related proceeding where the prosecution is wanting to use it anyway. The testing that was done doesn't fall under Massachusetts State Lab accreditation because of how it was done, but Brennan says that it was reliable and the doctor can come testify about how it's reliable anyway. It was allowed in last time, so I don't think that will change this time, but we'll see. The defense also asked to prevent the Commonwealth's expert, Dr. Wolf, from testifying about the cause and manner of death for John. Now, this is different, Dr. Wolf, than the ARCA expert. This one is a neurosurgeon, and Alessi argues that he isn't qualified to render his opinions on cause of death, or on the mechanism of injuries, or the conditions of the ground due to the weather. This all stems from Dr. Wolf's report that states that the mechanism of injury to John's head was him falling backwards. He says that the head injury was clearly inconsistent with any type of mechanism of injury like a bar or a hammer or a car hitting him directly. And he also says that the frozen ground was enough that when John fell back, his injuries were sustained. Now, there are a few problems here, and some we've been through before with other experts. The first issue is that there's no evidence saying that John fell backwards. It is, of course, one of the many options of what could have happened, but it's not something that can be concluded based on the evidence. Also, they don't know that the ground was frozen, and this witness can't say definitively that John fell backwards, and the head injury could have been from any number of things. So, there's all that. Also, Alessi argues that Dr. Wolf has expertise in treating injuries, but not determining the circumstances in which the injuries occurred. He says it's not sufficient in case law for someone to come in and say that they treat and know the brain, therefore they can make a leap to a conclusion about the manner of death. Now, Brennan obviously wants this testimony in. He says that Dr. Wolf should be allowed to testify this and say this to the jury, even though he's not a pathologist. He did a neuropathology internship, and he has a lot of experience treating brain injuries. Alessi points out that an internship from 40 years ago doesn't give him the ability to opine on this now, so we'll see. At this point, I'm flashing back to spending 2 full days of listening to Brennan argue that Dr. Russell wasn't qualified to give an opinion on the cause of injuries because she only treats injuries, and I am struggling to see how this is different, because to me, it seems like he's going against his own argument here, but I guess we'll see what the judge says. Brennan says that pathologists treat patients that are dead, and Dr. Wolf treats patients that are in trauma, and he's assessing injuries after they occur, diagnosing and attempting to save the patient's life. So he says that this means that Dr. Wolf understands causation of brain injury and what causes death. We'll be right back after this. Okay, so the next one is different and complicated, and it gets really spicy. Let's talk about the witness intimidation and harassment stuff. During the first trial, both sides agreed that the witness intimidation and the mention of harassment will not be brought up during trial. But it was a little weird because even though both the prosecution and defense agreed that they didn't want to introduce it, the judge was basically like, well, I'm not going to tell them no. So if the door opens in some way, then they can walk right through it. It did end up getting introduced, and Jackson has filed a motion for this trial, once again asking to keep it out. Jackson says that it is inadmissible and highly prejudicial testimony about harassment from a third party, the third party being Carney and whoever else did any of the things that Jen and Allie McCabe talked about during their testimony. So Jackson says no third party who is doing any of this stuff is directed by Karen Reed or under her control, and nobody speaks for Karen or the defense. Anything that's happening outside of the courtroom with this is completely independent of Karen, and the vile acts that were described in the first trial in no way are condoned by or connected to Karen or the defense. But we know that Jen McCabe blames Karen and the defense for this. And Jen even said something in the first trial about how this was someone that the defense was very familiar with. And when she did it, she looked directly at the jury and implied to the jury that the defense was connected to the harassment that she had just described. Now that puts a huge target on Karen's back, and Jackson argues that she shouldn't be held responsible for the actions of other people that she has no control over. And these are all things I agree with. So Jackson brings all of this up and he argues his point. Then he points out that the prosecutors tried to add more criminal charges to Karen, along with Aiden Carney, about a year ago. Now, they wanted to indict them both in March on allegations that they directly conspired to intimidate witnesses. They seized two phones from Karen in January of last year, and the search warrant accused her of working with Carney by providing information and pictures that they say Carney then used in his blog post to harass witnesses. Okay, so when evidence goes in front of a grand jury, they only hear the prosecution side. And the prosecutors can present it any way they want, and there's nobody to give any kind of defense, which is why there's that old saying that a grand jury could indict a ham sandwich. But even so, the grand jury looked at what they were given with the phone records, and even they didn't think that there was enough evidence to support charging Karen or Carney with anything. They returned what's called a no true bill. Now, this all happened in March of last year, before the trial started. And the prosecutors knew that. They had that information, and they didn't disclose it to the defense. Jackson says that that would have been exculpatory information for cross-examinations. For example, when Jen McCabe brought it up and implied that she suffered all of this at the hands of Karen Reed. Now, Judge Cannone interrupts Jackson right here, and I want to play this clip of what she said that she clearly remembers from the first trial.
So my memory is I kept it out, and then I have a very clear memory of you opening the door with Jennifer McCabe, and it came in through there.
The court did make that ruling that ultimately if the door is open, these witnesses are going to be able to talk about it.
But I kept it out prior to that.
Understood.
Okay.
I don't want to revisit that issue. The court made its ruling. I didn't think that we had opened the door. It was whatever that door was. It was on some very, very significant lubricant. It was going to be very easy.
Read the transcript.
I have several times.
Okay, so Judge Cannone tells Jackson that she has a very clear memory of Jackson opening the door to this with Jen McCabe. When he disagrees, she tells him to read the transcript. So I also have a clear memory. and a spreadsheet. And I went back to get these clips because my clear memory is very different than Judge Cannone's clear memory on this. I personally 100% disagree that Jackson opened the door to the witness intimidation stuff with Jen McCabe. I think that Jen McCabe opened the door herself and busted right on through it with a megaphone. Cross-examination of Jen McCabe by Alan Jackson began at the start of the day on day 15, and it lasted for like 6 hours or something like that. But it only took her 22 minutes to open her own door and bring up the harassment in front of the jury.
Following the events of January 28th, 29th, you spoke extensively to Chris and Julie Albert, correct?
What do you mean by extensively?
Did you speak at all?
Yes, we did.
Between then and now, to Chris and Julie Albert.
Do I speak to Chris and Julie Albert?
Have you spoken to them about these events between then and now?
About this case? Is that what you're asking?
Yes, Ms. McCabe, I'm asking about this case.
Of course I speak to them all the time about the vicious harassment we are all receiving.
Okay. That wasn't my question. My question was, did you talk to them about this case, Ms. McCabe?
Yes.
I realize you want to give additional answers and editorialize. I'm asking you very specific questions.
Mm-hmm. Objection.
So she brings this up in response to a question that Jackson was specific about. He was asking Jen about talking to Chris and Julie Albert about the events from that night. Now, that's a very simple and direct question, and Jen kind of avoided it for a while, and it seems like she very obviously wanted to bring up the harassment. Look, she's mad and she's not trying to hide it. Jackson tries to keep his line of questioning on track, but a few minutes later, Jen brings it up again.
And you've talked to them extensively about your observations and what your story or your version is. Is that right?
To be honest, not extensively. Speaking about it is very painful and difficult.
What does extensively mean? More than twice?
Well, you tell me.
I'm asking the questions, Ms. McCabe. That's how this works.
I understand, but extensively would mean almost every day.
Do you talk to them almost every day?
I do, but not about the case.
Do subjects about this case come up every day?
The harassment of the case does, yes.
What about the specific facts of the case?
No, it's the facts aren't spoken as much as the vicious harassment is spoken about.
Understood. So you've told them your version of the events, correct? And they've told you their version of the events.
Correct.
So once again, Jackson tries to get Jen back on topic. Now, later when Lally gets back up for redirect, he then elicits more testimony from Jen McCabe about this, asking her how long it had been going on, how often it was, asking her to describe specific incidents that she remembers, asking her who else has experienced any harassment, asking if Proctor's wife had experienced similar issues, etc., etc. So this opened the floor for Jen to turn directly to the jury and tell them everything that she wanted to say about the things that she says have been happening. And look, I know that I sound like a broken record, and I know that y'all get tired of me saying it, but I want to repeat it again. Harassment is never okay. It doesn't matter what you think happened or who you think did what. It is never okay to harass witnesses or defendants, and every single person has the presumption of innocence. We can have our thoughts, discuss our thoughts, we can be outraged, but harassing someone is never okay. If I had to deal with some of the things that Jen McCabe says happened to her, I'd be mad too. But looking at the jury and directly implying that it is Karen or the defense who orchestrated it, that's also not okay. And it is highly prejudicial, especially when the grand jury has already decided that there's no evidence of this. So Brennan, who has already said that he didn't watch the first trial, gets up and clutches his pearls at the defense's argument, saying that it defies reality. Again, just a reminder, he's giving this opinion, although he did not watch the first trial.
Appreciate the defense wanting to identify the line in which they would open the door to evidence about harassment and abuse of witnesses. I understand why that would be important. But to convert that into a speech that absolutely defies reality and grossly misstates the history and facts of this case is beyond me.
So Brennan says that Karen has said in an interview that she talked to Carney often and shared some public information with him. FYI, he specifically said public information here. And sharing public information is allowed. That's what we all do because it's, you know, public. But Brennan says that you would have to be oblivious not to assume that the information she shared was not generated to harass witnesses. Then, Brennan, who did not watch the first trial, gives his opinion on the situation with Jen McCabe's testimony from the first trial that he didn't watch.
But it is unfair to stand up here at this podium and suggest for a second that Ms. McCabe is using a witness box as some type of forum. She didn't drag herself into this case. She was dragged into it. And to suggest they can stand here and bash witnesses in the text of their argument, unsolicited attacks, because it pleases them and fits their narrative, is something I can't just sit by and listen to. The Commonwealth, the prosecutors weren't outside patting their bloggers on the butt for a job well done after witnesses were harassed at the family events. That didn't happen.
One of the things that frustrates me about Brennan's style is the hypocrisy of his arguments, because he acts completely offended at things that he himself does. But when he does them, it's okay. Then he accuses the other side of doing it, and he wants to give theatrical speeches while clutching his pearls for the cameras. Regardless, Brennan then takes some personal jabs at the defense, saying that Jackson should have had control of his questions so that they didn't open the door. So Judge Cannone asked Brennan if he plans on bringing this in during his case in chief. And Brennan says no. He says he doesn't think that it should have to come in, doesn't think it should have come in during the first trial, isn't planning on bringing it in during this one. Okay, so then why did we just go through all of that? And also, we know that Brennan has filed the motion asking for some of the phone records from Aiden Carney, aka Turtle Boy's case. He says that Karen and Turtle Boy communicated. She shared information with him, and then he used that information during his alleged witness intimidation, and Brennan wants access to all of that to use against Karen, because he believes it will show consciousness of guilt. So based on that, it seems like Brennan is wanting to get all up into this alleged witness intimidation discussion at trial, right? But he's saying he has no intention of it here. So which is it? Now, Jackson gets a chance to respond to Brennan's speech, and he obviously isn't happy. Brennan got up there and basically told the court that Jackson needed to be a better attorney. And while he's bashing Jackson, he accused Jackson of bashing Jen McCabe. And Jackson responds. Now, for the sake of time, I have trimmed some of the parts of this, but the full argument is available on my YouTube channel.
He said that I stood up here just a second ago and attacked witnesses and bashed witnesses and made fraudulent statements. Was he listening? I didn't bash a witness. I didn't attack a witness. I didn't make any fraudulent statements. The Commonwealth made their best effort, to tether Ms. Reed to Aiden Kearney. And they did it through a grand jury. And those members of the grand jury said, no, it's not true. It didn't happen. So Mr. Brennan can stand up all he wants and say, I saw a TV show and I saw this and I heard an interview, and clearly there's been communication between Ms. Reed and Mr. Kearney. Except, sure, there may have been communication. That's very different from directing witness intimidation, directing witness harassment for the purposes of undermining a prosecution. That's what they've accused her of, and they failed. And then they kept that from us when they failed. So nobody's up here, Your Honor, and I take issue with Mr. Brennan's tone and tenor. We can all be professional. We can all advocate very zealously and robustly. But let's keep it professional. I didn't stand up here and attack a witness, or what did he say, bash witnesses, use this as an opportunity to bash people. But we could calm the drama down just a little bit and probably get a little further.
So the defense team is getting pretty sick of the personal shots that Brennan is taking at them. And Jackson asked to take the drama down some and be professional. Now, the judge says that she will take this motion about harassment under advisement, but it's not quite over yet. On Thursday morning before the hearing starts for Karen Reed, Brennan is in the courtroom, but this time at the defense table is Aiden Carney, and at the judge's bench is Judge Adam Sisitsky. Brennan is asking the judge to have Special Prosecutor Cosgrove, in Carney's case, turn over the stuff they found on two of the phones when they searched them in connection to his witness intimidation charges. So even though the grand jury said there's no evidence that Karen had anything to do with conspiring with Carney for witness intimidation, Brennan still says he wants that phone information because he thinks it will show that she did conspire with Carney, and he wants to use whatever he can find against her to show consciousness of guilt. So this judge, Judge Sisitsky, is very different from Judge Cannone. He pushes back on Brennan instead of letting him do and say as he pleases, and he wants to know how this is relevant to Karen's case. He says the data had everything from the meeting notes to calendar invites to texts and videos, and a ton of stuff that had nothing to do with communication between Karen and Carney. So he wants Brennan to explain how it's relevant. Now, as the judge is asking Brennan this question, Karen and her defense team come busting into the courtroom. Well, okay, maybe that's dramatic, but it felt like a dramatic moment. Karen and her attorneys, David Yannetti, Alan Jackson, Liza Little, and Bob Alessi, come walking into the courtroom and kind of crash Brennan's party. The look on his face was definitely frustration. He holds his hand up, like, to stop them as they all grab seats at the defense table along with Carney and his attorney, Tim Bradle. Now, Brennan says this is a ruling with Mr. Carney, and he doesn't know why Karen and her defense team are even here. Jackson tells the judge that he's not even sure which case number this hearing is taking place under, Karen's or Carney's. And he says that this never should have been called without Karen being able to be present with her representation and be heard. Jackson says he will step back and be a little mouse in the room, not bothering anything while they go through their arguments. He just wants to be heard after. Brennan, of course, objects. He doesn't want them there.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, Your Honor, I do object. Ms. Reed's counsel and Ms. Reed do not have standing for this motion. I don't believe they should be sitting at the table for this motion. It's a Rule 17 motion of third party. She has no privacy interest in these materials. She has no standing to object, and she's not a party on the Rule 17.
Thank you, ADA Brennan. She is a party in this case, and I'll allow her to sit at counsel table and to have representation, and I'll consider whether I'll hear from her counsel concerning the substance of the motion and her considerations there, too.
We appreciate the court accommodating us.
Wow, how different this judge is from Judge Cannone, right? So the judge gets right back down to asking Brennan to explain how this is relevant. And Brennan says it's the communications that Carney had with any of the witnesses or their family members, any pictures or videos of him intimidating witnesses, and any kind of data evidence of him intimidating witnesses that he's interested in. So Carney's attorney, Tim Bradle, tells the judge, look, Brennan has already agreed not to submit any of the witness intimidation claims to the jury in Karen's trial unless the door is opened, which he says is never going to happen. But, Bradle says, they're concerned about Brennan's bizarre interpretation of the witness intimidation statute, and he refers to this as the ultimate fishing expedition. He also points out that the search warrants for Carney's phone are from more than a year ago. And Brennan is just now trying to get it because he's hoping to get some last-minute bombs for his trial. Liza Little speaks on behalf of Karen and says that there are two issues. The prosecution hasn't shown that they can prepare for trial without this, which is a requirement for a judge's rule on this. And the second one is that they haven't shown that they'll find anything relevant. This is just a fishing expedition. But here's where things are going to get really messy. The judge asked Brennan if he's going to ask witnesses on the stand about the alleged intimidation because he just told Judge Cannone a couple days earlier that he's not planning on it. And Brennan says he's only going to do that if the door is opened. But he says that's a totally separate issue from consciousness of guilt. This is going to get messy, y'all. So Judge Sisitsky ended up granting the motion in part, meaning he narrowed it down. Brennan's allowed to have any communication between Karen and Carney that has to do with any kind of witness intimidation or if there's any text about him doing anything to them or any pictures or videos that have been sent between them, anything like that. But that's it. The judge narrowed it down a lot. But Carney has already made a public response, stating that there will be zero messages between him and Karen that they find on his phone, and he says that he hasn't intimidated anyone, so there will be no evidence of that on his phone either. And now for some big news. After 3 days in front of the Massachusetts State Police Trial Board, lead investigator Michael Proctor's disciplinary hearing has now concluded. Proctor was relieved of duty and suspended without pay after the conclusion of the last trial. Literally moved out of the detective unit at Norfolk DA's office within hours of the mistrial being declared. The same day that his hearing concluded, Proctor's family issued their first statement, and it seems like they share the disdain for Karen that Proctor himself has shown. Now, normally these kind of statements are directly from the person in the hot seat, and they usually include some sort of acknowledgement of their wrongdoing, but this one is, well, different. It starts by saying that they're speaking out because of egregiously false statements made by Karen and her defense team, and they want the public to look at the facts of the case. They say Proctor has been defamed, maligned, and falsely labeled corrupt by the, quote, alleged murderer, her family, her defense team, and a mob of her followers, end quote. They also accuse Karen's defense of trying to paint her as the victim to taint the jury pool. The statement says that the prosecution believes that this is an open and shut case, despite what the jury believed, I guess, and they defended Proctor's text by saying, who hasn't said something regrettable in moments of stress, shock, or sadness? Now, Proctor's wife and sister were also in the media doing interviews. They said in an interview with News Center 5 that they continued to support Proctor. And while they admit that the texts that he sent about Karen were unprofessional and regrettable, they deny that there was any kind of issue that influenced his conclusion that Karen Reed was guilty of hitting John O'Keefe with her car and leaving him to die. Now, Proctor's wife said that their world is crumbling and that they faced a lot of harassment because of the case. She says that he was only venting in those texts, that he was only upset because the evidence pointed to, quote, this woman killing a fellow Boston police officer, end quote. His sister said that there's no doubt in her mind that her brother had nothing to do with framing Karen, and she said that she thinks that the evidence and investigation shows that. Both women say that they don't believe the messages from Proctor justify the harassment they've received, and they accuse her of conspiring and colluding with Aidan Carney. Their statement said that investigations and a grand jury ended in only Karen being charged, and they want the focus to shift back on her and away from Proctor. But less than a week later, the trial board found Proctor guilty of unsatisfactory performance and alcoholic beverage charges. Colonel Jeffrey Noble, the superintendent of the Massachusetts State Police, decided to accept the trial board's recommendation to terminate Michael Proctor from his position as trooper. So, as of Wednesday, March 19th, 2025, Proctor has been dishonorably discharged from the state police. Colonel Noble said in his statement, quote, our mission to deliver the highest level of police services depends on the public's trust in our professionalism and integrity. It is incumbent upon me, as well as every member of this department, to hold one another accountable when any member compromises our mission by failing to uphold our values. As superintendent, my role demands that I do what is in the best interest of the department. My decision to terminate Mr. Proctor follows a thorough, fair, and impartial process. I have weighed the nature of the offenses, their impact on our investigative integrity, and the importance of safeguarding the reputations of our dedicated women and men in the state police. This decision reflects our unwavering commitment to upholding our values, enhancing public trust, and ensuring the highest standards of service and accountability. Finally, recognizing the ways in which this process has affected the family of Boston police officer John O'Keefe, I would also like to renew our condolences to them. End quote. Now, Proctor can appeal the trial board's decision to the Civil Service Commission, but according to NBC Boston, state police say that they're confident that the evidence is sufficient for civil service to affirm Colonel Noble's decision to terminate him. Proctor's family released a statement. They said that they are truly disappointed with the trial board's decision. They said that he is basically a scapegoat, and that Proctor and his detectives led a meticulous and thorough investigation of integrity. They also call it a wrongful termination. They say great harm and defamation in this case has inflicted on him and his family. So how will this impact the next trial? Well, this gives a lot of weight to the things that the defense is saying about Proctor. The lead investigator was fired over his conduct in this case, and they said that he provided confidential information to people outside of law enforcement. That goes beyond just gross and offensive text. That's him not doing his job properly. And it was so bad that he lost his job over it. They also said in the report that his failures here, this inappropriate and unprofessional conduct, created an image that Proctor is biased in his dealings with Karen Reed. That is exactly what the defense has been saying all along. And now they have the trial board that has agreed with them, and they fired Proctor because of it. That will probably go a lot further with the jury than just the defense saying it. Now it's all official, in writing, and it's a much bigger deal. Now, remember, the defense has already asked to get all of the internal affairs investigation stuff, and Brennan opposed it. Now that Proctor has been fired, it kind of changes things. They've already been given all of the information from the investigation and the ruling from the trial board. But Brennan's already said that there are things that he is going to object to that he does not want to come in. And it's probably going to be all of the things that the defense is the most excited to get into the trial. So we'll be hearing more about that next week. This week, the defense also requested to delay the start of the trial because they have an appeal pending in federal court. And even though the Commonwealth agreed to that, Judge Cannone said no. They have almost 1,400 people scheduled to report for jury duty the first week of April, and a lot of those will probably be for this case. They expect it to take a while to seat this jury because of the publicity, so Judge Cannone said that they aren't going to delay the start of that process. But she will wait on swearing the jury in, and hopefully there will be an expedited answer in federal court between now and then. But I know she won't wait forever. Next week, we'll go over the rest of the motions that were heard. The feistiness in the attorneys continues, and it gets heated in court, to the point where the judge steps in. I'm going to break all of that down and let you know what got us to that point, so you don't want to miss that. Plus, Karen's back in court on Tuesday for all of the final motions. And with the arguments that we're hearing, we're starting to get an idea of just how different this trial will be.
My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.